So Rabbi Schechter is coming to us as a Torah scholar, great Talmud Chacham, who is teaching us Torah in many areas, and one of them is to know these very special and interesting and controversial somewhat rules of Jewish medical ethics. The topic this morning is organ transplantation.
Thank you very much. Organ transplants can be discussed in two different styles. Either a living person decides on his own he wants to donate an organ to someone else, or you want to take an organ from a dead body. So first we'll discuss if a living person is prepared to donate an organ. We have a discussion in the Gemara in Bava Kamma whether a person is permitted to mutilate his own body. And the conclusion of the Gemara is also Lord Amalach Babiatzma. A person is not permitted to mutilate his own body. The Pashta says that one shouldn't be permitted to take blood either. And one shouldn't be permitted to cut out any organs from his body. How do we donate any blood? So the Rav Moshe Feinstein has a discussion of this. So it's usually assumed, Rav Moshe Feinstein gives a different answer, it's usually assumed that the reason why one is permitted to donate blood is because there is a possibility, even if it's less than 50-50 chance, that we will save someone's life by that. So a Sofik Pikuach Nefesh, I'm allowed to drive a patient to the hospital on Shabbos, even though the patient may die, even though the doctors may not succeed in keeping him alive, a Sofik Pikuach Nefesh, or a Sveik Sveika Pikuach Nefesh, is also Deicha Shabbos. Even if the odds are, let's say, 9-1, that the patient is not going to die anyway, even if I don't drive him to the hospital. Or the odds are 9-1, even if I do drive him to the hospital, he's going to die anyway. So the Gemara says, Lehocho b'tikoch nefashu sachar harayim. The Gemara says, the end of the first parak in Ksubis, the end of Yuma, that you don't follow what the odds are. Even if the odds are highly unlikely that there's going to be any saving of a life here, still the din is that you're permitted and obligated to be Mechal Shabbos and teach Reifus and so on. Unless there's such a far-fetched chance, unless the odds are 10,000-1, that's utterly ridiculous. Then the Chasam Sofer writes in a tshuva that's quoted by the Pischi Tshuva in Yeridei, that's not considered a Sofik Pikuach Nefesh. But if it's a Sofik, that's a reasonable Sofik, that people think maybe, there's a chance that maybe yes. So then, even if the odds are that you're not really saving his life, the odds are he's going to die anyway, the odds are he's going to live anyway, so the din is that Sofik or Svek Svek and Pikuach Nefesh is Decha Shabbos. So in principle, it really should not be permissible. Let's say, I'm going to take blood and throw it out in the garbage. So I'm going to let blood. So to let blood is also Vadam Lach B'Biyasma. That's an Issa Havar. I'm going to cut off one of my fingers. If I have six fingers, then I cut off one finger in order to look normal. That's permissible. But I have five fingers, I cut off one finger, I'm mutilating my body. So that's a prohibition of Chavolah. But if I'm cutting off the finger in order to save someone else's life, if there is such a possibility, I have two kidneys and I can live with one kidney and I'll donate one kidney to someone else to save his life. So it's prohibited to cut out a kidney from your body. But if there's a chance that it may save someone else's life, so then we would say that Pikuach Nefesh would be there. What if, let's say, the doctors are not so sure? By my donating my kidney, I may lose my life. Am I permitted to put my life into danger in order to save someone else? So, Mavadai Sakana, if I'm going to put my life into danger in order to save someone else who may save someone else, so that's ridiculous. Why shift to Sofik Sakana? If this poor person never, he may die, so why should I put my life into Sofik Sakana to save his life on the Sofik Sakana? That doesn't make any sense. But if the other one is mamish holding by dying, the patient is so sick, the doctors say, if he doesn't get a kidney, he's vadai going to die. And I have two kidneys, and they're not sure whether my donating my kidney may hasten my death or not. They're not sure. So that's a big dispute in the poskim. So there's different opinions in Shulchan Aruch. Some are of the opinion that it's forbidden for me to put my life into a Sofik Sakana, even in order to save someone else from a Vadai Sakana. That's one opinion. That's how the Balatanya, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, has his own Shulchan Aruch, Shulchan Aruch Arab. That's the way he writes, both in Chosh Mishpat, and he has very little of Chosh Mishpat. That's one of the things that he writes, and he has it in Hilchos Shabbos as well. He seems to paskin that it's forbidden It's not exactly 100% clear, but that's what it seems his opinion is, that it's prohibited for me to put my life into Safik Sakana, even in order to save someone else from Avadei Sakana. Others are of the opinion that it's permissible to, it's a midas chasidus, but you're not obligated to. How can you tell me I'm a chiyuv to put my life into danger in order to save someone else's life? And the third opinion is that it's obligatory. That's how Rav Soloveitchik used to say that his grandfather, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, was of the opinion that one is obligated to put his life into a safek sakana in order to save someone else from avadai sakana. He said that at one time in Europe there was a cholera epidemic, and many people were lying in the street half dead. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said that cholera is a contagious disease. So Rav Chaim Soloveitchik said that the healthy living people are mechuyev to treat those who are half dead, even though they themselves, they should take all the precautions possible. Even though they themselves may develop this sickness, they may pick it up and they may die, they're mechuyev to put themselves into safek sakana in order to save the others from avadei sakana. He himself also did. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik himself also took care of the patients who were sick. He himself did not die. Some of the people whom he instructed to take care of the patients did die from the epidemic. That was his opinion, that you're obligated to. To say that a person is obligated to donate a kidney in order to save someone else's life, someone is vada holding by dying because his kidneys are failing. So, to treat the patient, a doctor should treat a patient even though he may get the disease, or to take care of the people who are dying from cholera even though you yourself may develop the sickness. So Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was of the opinion you're obligated to do that. These were the three opinions. It's prohibited to, it's permissible to, or you're obligated to. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik held that you're obligated to. But to say that one is obligated to donate a kidney in order to save someone else's life, so that the poskim, the Pischei Tshuva and Yerideya quotes in the Chesh Mish, but also quotes from the Radvaz and the Tshuva, he doesn't think one is obligated to donate an organ from his body, just like I'm not obligated to give up my life in order to save someone else's life. So you can say I'm obligated to donate an organ. I'm going to be missing that organ for the rest of my life. Can you say you're obligated to donate blood? The blood is going to grow back later on. That could be that you're obligated to donate blood. If you think that by donating your blood you can save someone else's life, you're going to get back the blood. But to say that you're obligated to give up a kidney, so that is usually assumed that that's considered a midas chasidus. That's very commendable, but to say one is obligated is hard to believe. I think so. Rabbi Soloveitchik never discussed it, but I assume he only meant one is obligated to put himself into a safek sakana, like by the cholera epidemic, the incident that he said. But to donate an organ, I would assume that he wouldn't disagree with the Radvaz. I would assume so. So this is the issue. This is the issue regarding organ transplants. If a living person is prepared to donate his organ to someone else. So there is a suffix mitzad, the patient. Years ago, when they first started organ transplants, so the body has a natural tendency to reject all foreign matter. So the issue may be that this fellow who's going to die because his kidneys have failed, the doctors say he only has 2 months to go. Now we're going to take out his kidney and we're going to give him a different kidney from a healthy person. His body, he may die earlier because of the fact that he's getting this organ transplant, if there is such a possibility. So that's a question that's discussed by the Gemara. If a person knows that he has, the doctors think he has, nobody ever knows for sure, doctors think he has 2 months to go, is he permitted to undergo surgery or permitted to undergo some procedure which may theoretically extend his life significantly? And on the other hand, may hasten his death. He may die less than 2 months. So he, in a certain sense, he's committing suicide. So it's a suffix suicide. So are you permitted to commit suffix suicide? You're not allowed to. Suffix deraita l'chomer. But over here, he's committing suffix suicide because of the possibility that it may extend his life. So the Gemara says that is up to the patient to decide whether he wants to run the risk or not. And if he decides in favor of that risk, he's prepared to risk the 2 months that he has in order to possibly extend his life significantly, then he may make that choice, and I can do the surgery for him. And it may turn out that I kill him. The doctor is permitted to do the surgery because the patient gave him permission, that's okay. If the patient gives me permission to kill him, he wants me to do a mercy killing to he's suffering. That you're not allowed to do. You're not allowed to kill a patient in order to save him from pain. But to do such a procedure that may extend his life significantly, even though it may kill him, earlier that we assume is permissible. This is Gemara in Maseches Avodah Zarah, learns that from the Pasuk in Sefer Melachim. Elisha was the student of Eliyahu HaNavi, and he was a Navi after Eliyahu HaNavi went up to heaven in the fiery chariot. And on one occasion, Elisha was a Balmoifes. He cured sick people. So on one occasion, there was a general from the Goyish nation who had tzaras. He had leprosy. And he went to all the doctors where he lived, and no one could cure him. And he had a Jewish shivcha, a Jewish girl who had come from Eretz Yisrael. So the girl said, "Why don't you go to Elisha HaNavi?" She said, "Go to the tzaddik in Eretz, go to Elisha HaNavi, and he'll be able to cure you, because he's a Navi." So he came to Eretz Yisrael with a letter from the king of his country, that he's the general of the army, and he wants the Navi to cure him from his leprosy. So Elisha HaNavi told him he should go bathe in the Yarden, and his leprosy will be cured. So he said, "That's ridiculous, but I'm going to bathe in the Yarden. I already bathed myself in Mono Afarfar, in all of the clean waters in the country where I live. The waters there are cleaner. This is ridiculous. This Navi doesn't know what he's talking about." So the people said, "You traveled so far already. Try it out. What do you have to lose?" So he bathed in the Yarden, and he was cleansed of his sickness. He was so appreciative that he suffered for so many years from Tzara, so appreciative. So he came to Elisha Navi, and he said he wants to pay him. He offered him gold and silver and cash and clothing and everything. And he said, "It's okay. I'm salaried by the Rebbeinu Shlomo. I don't need any tips. Keep all the money. Goodbye." So Elisha HaNavi had a shamnis. A lot of times tzaddikim, a lot of times big rabbonim tzaddikim have shamasim who are not on the level of the tzaddikim. So he had a shamnis who was gehazi. He used to make fun of Rav Moshe Feinstein. Had Talmidim who used to hang around him. So sometimes the Rabbanim would be angry at the Shamasim. They used to call him Gehazi, because it is Gehazi in Tanakh. So the Pasuk says that Gehazi chased after the general, and he tells him, "My master changed his mind. He says, give me the money and I'll bring it back." So Elisha Navsi gave him the money, the gold and the silver and everything, and then he kept it for himself. It was a lie. So when Elisha HaNavi found out about it, he cursed him, and he said, "The tzaras of Naaman, tidbak b'cho u'b'banecho, you should suffer from tzaras. You shegetz, you din achil Hashem, you and your three sons should suffer." So the story is related in Melachim. Abo mitzvaron yeshem pesach shar shomron. The din is that in Yir HaMokef Eschaim, a city in Eretz Yisrael that has a wall around it from the days of Yishul Binon, has a higher level of kedusha than the rest of Eretz Yisrael. And what's the relevance? What's the significance? We read the Megillah on Tezvav Ador, on Shushan Purim, instead of on Purim, and in Yir HaMokev Eschem Oysur Shulbinon. But what, that's a Din Midirabana, on the level of the Raisa, what's the biblical difference in our Torah? So the Pasuk says in Chumash that a Mitzorah is not forbidden to enter in Yir HaMokev Eschem Oysur Shulbinon. So the Pasuk says Shomron was a city that did not exist in the days of Yishur Binon. Shomron, it says, was built way later. And nonetheless, they followed a minhag. It wasn't really a din. They followed a minhag to treat it as if it had the status of an Yir HaMokev Eschem. So the Abo Mitzrayim was sitting Pesach Shar Shomron. Gehazi and his three sons, these were not the biggest tzaddikim in Klal Yisrael. These were the people who were punished because of the curse of Elisha HaNavi. They weren't such tzaddikim. They were sitting Pesach Shar Shomron. The city was under siege by the enemy. Everybody ran out of food and drink, and they thought they were all going to drop dead. And they thought that the enemy army is still surrounding the city. So the Abo Mitzrayim figured the jig is up over here. They only have another couple of days. They're going to die within soon, a day or two. Less than a week, they have to live. They're going to die. They figured they may as well surrender to the enemy. If they'll take us prisoners of war, so they'll give us food. We'll live another couple of days, maybe. And if they kill us, so we'll die. So they went with a white flag to surrender to the enemy. And they start walking, and they realize there's no enemy. There's nobody there. So they walk around, they start eating, they're eating and drinking and having a good time. And then they see there's gold and silver and money and everything, taking all the money. Then they realize, what about all the people in the city Shaman? They're often dying from hunger. So they run back into the city Shaman. They were not sitting in the city, they were sitting outside of the city, because they were in the right. Thank you. So they go back to the city, and they tell all the people, come, there's food, there's drink, there's everything, there's money, take whatever you want. So at first the people in the city thought that it was a trick, that the soldiers are hiding somewhere, so they first said they're going to send the horses through, they realized there's nobody there. So everybody came out, everybody was eating and drinking and shine. So the Gemara says that because this is recorded in Tanakh, not that these were the world's greatest Talmid HaChamim, these are not the chief rabbis of Eretz Yisrael, that we should listen to their psak, but the Tanakh records this risk that they took, that they're going to surrender to the enemy, if they kill us, they kill us, if not, we'll live for longer. So we see that this is approved by Tanakh. The Chayla has the right to choose this option. You're allowed to... The patient can agree to take a risky procedure even though he may lose the 2 months, the chai yishor that he has. The Gemara coins two terms, chai yishor, chai yoylam. He's going to live forever or he's going to live chai yishor. Nobody lives forever. What do you mean chai yoylam? What do you mean chai yishor for an hour? So Rabbi Moshe Feinstein quotes Rabbi Chaim Moshe. Not everybody agrees, but those who disagree are the lesser luminaries, putting it mildly. And the major question Rabbi Chaim Moser and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein both say the Chayisho means if you think you don't have 12 months to go, if you have less than a year to go. Rashi and the Gemara says a day or two, Chayisho, because Rashi is talking about the Abba Mitzaroim. So the Abba Mitzaroim only had a day or two left to live. They thought they're going to die in another day or two without any food or drink. But the definition of Chayisho means if you think you have less than a year to go. Chayola means if the procedure or the operation will extend your life possibly for more than a year. So the patient has the right to make that decision to risk his life. It's not considered an aveira of suicide if he thinks that by having this procedure, having this surgery, his life may be extended. And even though the odds are against it, because when they were surrendering to the enemy, let's say today, if Israeli soldiers would surrender to Palestinian terrorists, they would be killed on the spot. Most of the time. The odds are they would be killed on the spot. So then also, the likelihood was that they were going to get killed on the spot in Yimisun of Amasnu. Because there was a slim chance in Michayuna Vinichyera, so the Chayla has the right to choose that option. This is sometimes the halacha that it's up to the Chayla to decide. The rabbis can't make this decision. If it's a risky thing, it's up to the Chayla. We have such a just parenthetical, we have such a din. The Talmud tells us that the 40 years that the Jews were traveling in the Midbar, in the desert, only Shevet Levi fulfilled the mitzvah of Bris Milah, and the other Shvatim did not. Why? So the Gemara says the weather conditions were such that it was a shtikol sakana, it wasn't completely safe to perform Bris Milah. So because it was a suffix sakana, so all of the other Shvatim did not perform Bris Milah. But Shevet Levi did perform Bris Milah. So they had an Orthodox rabbi there. They had Moshe Rabbeinu. So what did he have to say? So he should have said to Shevet Levi, you're killing your children. Safik Sakana, don't perform. He should have told the other Shvatim, you have to perform Bris Milah also. The rabbi says, you're right, and you're right, and you're right, and everybody's right. He doesn't take a stand. What's going on here? The answer is that it wasn't a 50-50 Safik Sakana. If it would have been a real 50-50 Safik Sakana, Moshe Rabbeinu would say, no one is allowed to perform Bris Milah. If it would be anywhere near 50-50, if it would be 75-25, we would also say no one's allowed to perform a Bris Milah, even though there's a 75% likelihood that all the babies will survive. 25% chance that you're going to die. So you're not allowed to perform Bris Milah. The answer was it was 99% safe and 1% not safe. So what's Taka the Din if it's 99% safe and 1% not safe? So then the Din is that it's up to the Chayla to decide whether he's nervous or not. So those parents who had more bitochen, so they said, we're not nervous. So Shevet Levi had more bitochen. This is the Chiddush. We should really say it's up to the child to decide. And the child is only 8 days old. So the child does know. So I would have thought maybe the parents have no right to make a decision for the child. That's how Rabbi Tzvi Hafner has a tshuva. In his Sefer Melamed Lehoyel, he discusses a young child has such a, his bisakona, and is a risky procedure, and the procedure may extend the life of the child and may kill the child earlier. So he says the parents have no right to take a stand on the matter. If the doctors recommend this because they think there's a good chance that this is going to succeed, so then you do the procedure. If the doctors are afraid to recommend because everything is iffy and everything is questionable, so he says the only one who has the right to make the decision is the patient himself. And here the patient is a little child, so the parents have no right to make the decision on behalf of the child. So the pashtus is not like Rabbi David Zvi Hafner. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein writes in his sefer, he doesn't say it's based on this gemara, he writes on his own, that in such a situation, the next of kin, the one who is in charge of taking care of the patient, has to make the decision like over here. The parents made the decision for the children. This is a serious shaila in Eretz Yisrael. A lot of people decide to move to the areas where it's dangerous. People move to Sderot. Some people got killed in Sderot. So is it permissible for the parents to decide that moving the whole family to Sderot? The children are afraid to live there. Is that right? If the children are old enough to know whether something is dangerous or not, Taka, the parents have no right to make a decision on behalf of their children. If the children are little, they're so young, they don't know b'chlal what's going on. So then it would appear from the Gemara that since it's the parents' responsibility to take care of their children, so the decision is up to the parents. But sometimes the halacha says that decisions, medical decisions, may be made by the cholim. Even though different cholim are going to choose different options, some cholim would rather live the 2 months and not run the risk of losing the 2 months that they have, and other cholim will choose to live longer. This is not a shaila for rabbanim to pass. The Gemara says this is up to the cholim to decide. So that's how we pass the halacha. That if the cholim wants to have this organ transplant in order to possibly extend his life, even though the odds are that he's going to die earlier, but there is a slim chance that this will extend his life, so that's permissible for the cholim to choose that option. And not only the cholim is allowed to choose it, the doctor is allowed to proceed and do the surgery. Even though ritzicha, killing someone else, is more common than suicide, since the cholim chose this route, so the doctor is allowed to help him over here. Very often we don't discuss organ transplant from a living person who's donating the organ. We talk about taking organs from a dead body. So, much of modern medicine was developed based on research that they did on dead bodies, based on autopsies. They did autopsies on people who died from different diseases, and then they discovered a lot of information about the way the diseases developed. And we assume that this helped save a lot of people's lives. The medical information saved a lot of people's lives. So in the 1700s, when they were beginning to do autopsies, they were realizing that you can gain a lot of medical information. So the Rabbanim were discussing the prohibition of autopsy. The Gemara says in Chulin, in the first parak, that it's not permissible to perform an autopsy on a dead body. And then the Yehuda and the Poskim from the 1700s write that they think that there are three prohibitions, there are three issues involved. One issue is that if you're dealing with the Jewish body, there is a mitzvah of kvura. There's a mitzvah to bury a Jewish body on the same day that he dies. You have to bury that body the same day. Unless, let's say, the children live in Eretz Yisrael, or the children live in South Africa, and you want the children to attend the funeral, or you want to notify more people that they should attend the funeral. If you're going to have this, a person dies at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you have to bury him before the Shkia. They won't be able to notify enough people. It'll be a bizoyan to the mace. So if you leave over the body till tomorrow, l'chvod of shalom mace, so then we derive from the psukim chumash that that is permissible. That's the common practice. If they lean over the mace, leave over the mace till the next day, out of cover on mace, then it's permissible. So if you're going to do an autopsy, you're going to postpone the burial for a while, not l'chvod shalamei. So this is one issue. This is not allowed. Bitl mitzvah kvura. Number two, we learn out from the whole pasuk in Chumash, the Torah says we have to bury the mason because man is created b'tzelem alakim and b'nei yisrael abonim lamakam, So we learn out that there's a violation of Nivul Hames. There's an aver to be mevazeh a dead body. There's an aver, there's a bigger aver to be mevazeh a living person. That's a bigger chet. That's, we don't think about that. But it's a lesser aver to be mevazeh the body of a dead person. That's the yisur Nivul Hames. And then the third prohibition that the poskim discuss is that a Jewish mace is also bahano. You're not allowed to gain any benefit from a dead body. So if you're going to do an autopsy on a dead body, or let's say the medical students who go to medical school, so they usually learn anatomy from a cadaver, so to learn anatomy is also considered getting hanor. So you're getting hanor from a mace, that's also, it's also to get hanor from a mace. So the poskim wrote at that time, even though in Shulchan Aruch there is a discussion whether only Jewish dead bodies are also bahanor, or even non-Jewish dead bodies. The Pesukim in Chumash only speak about Jewish dead bodies. The Gemara seems to say explicitly in quite a few places that a non-Jewish dead body is muta bahanor. You don't have a mitzvah of kvura on non-Jewish dead bodies. It seems no iser nivul hames, and the Pashtus says that there's no iser hanor. In the Shulchan Aruch, they write that it's not permissible to get hanor from Meisei Akum. You're not allowed to get benefit from a non-Jewish dead body. But the later poskim say we assume this is only a chumrah that was introduced in the days of the Achronim, the late Rishonim, the Achronim. And if you have, let's say, a student who wants to go to medical school, he wants to learn anatomy, so since the non-Jews don't consider it a bizoyin ames, they don't consider that any bizoyin ames. So strictly speaking, on a non-Jewish body, we assume it's mutar b'hanor. If it's l'shem mitzvah, first wants to go to medical school, so we allow that issa to be violated. It's not a real issa medina, it's an issa mitam minik. So this minik, the makam yashtikal mitzvah, we are matter this. The question is, let's say if you have, you want to use an organ transplant from a dead body, from a non-Jewish dead body, to help a Jewish person. So there is a makam mitzvah to treat a patient. So if you're just dealing with a non-Jewish body, so we would say the whole Issa is only mitam minig, so we would be mekel b'makam mitzvah. What if it's a Jewish body? We have a real Issa hanor. There is a room to be mekel to heal a person by using an organ from a dead body. So the Mishnah LaMelech has a commentary on the Rambam. He discusses this prohibition that a meis is also b'hanor. Is this a real Issa deraisa, or is this only an Issa derabbanan? Maybe it's only an Issa derabbanan. He quotes Tosfos, says explicitly that it's an Issa deraisa. He's not so convinced that Tosfos is right. We usually assume, like Tosfos here, that it is an Issa deraisa. So the only time one would be mekel on an Issa deraisa to get hanor benefit from the meis is if you have a real case of a suffix pikuach nefesh. Not all organ transplants are really for the purpose of pikuach nefesh. But if it would be for the sake of a suffix pikuach nefesh, then we would say that it would be permissible. Pikuach nefesh means to save a person's life, not to save a limb, not to have functioning of all of the limbs. We paskin, there's one opinion that sakana saver is called pikuach nefesh, the me'iri, masechas avedizor, is of the opinion that to save any limb, the use of a limb is considered pikuach nefesh, either saving a life or a limb, and that's not the accepted opinion. So when we paskin, that pikuach nefesh only means to save one's life. So let's say if you're going to use an organ transplant from a dead Jewish body, in order to, for a vital organ that's going to save someone's life, that's mamish pikuach nefesh, that we would be matzah. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a discussion regarding a cornea transplant. Tosfos has two opinions regarding or hameis. Bisar hameis, flesh from a dead body, is also banor. Tosfos assumes that's an issa deraisa, that's a biblical prohibition. What about skin? Skin is two opinions in Tosfos whether the issa hanov or hameis, I involve resh. Or hameis is that menatar midirabanan. So Moshe Feinstein says, we're not so convinced about the Tosfos in the first place, that Meis also banor is menatar. Maybe the Mishnah Melech is right, that it's only midirabanan. And even though we're machma like Tosfos, but he doesn't think we're mechuyev to be machma all the way, even with respect to or hameis. So he says, we can rely on that opinion in Tosfos that or hameis, the skin, is only also banor midirabanan. Then Moshe writes that the cornea has the same status as or. When I read Rav Moshe Feinstein's shuv, I didn't understand why. So we often have students visiting from the yeshiva to eat by us on Shabbos. And so I once asked one of the medical students, I didn't understand what's the difference between the skin and the flesh. I thought the skin is just the end of the flesh. He explained some whole explanation that it's two different things. The skin is not the edge of the flesh. The skin is skin and the flesh is flesh. So whatever his explanation was, I didn't get it. So I said, and what would you say about cornea? Cornea is flesh and cornea is skin. He says, no, cornea is like skin. Okay. So biologically, for some reason or another, he said that Rav Moshe Feinstein doesn't explain that point. But that's what this the medical student, who's now a doctor, that's what he explained to me. That somehow the cornea has the status of skin as opposed to flesh. So Moshe Feinstein says he thinks he can be makel that Or HaMeis is only an Iser Derabbanon. So if you're only dealing with an Iser Derabbanon, you could be makel even if there's no Sakanas Nefashis, even if it's only Sakanas Saver, even if you just want to give the person the ability to see. You're not saving his life, but you just want to give him the ability to see.
Is there an opinion that a blind man is like a dead man? You don't have to use
that? Exactly. That's what I was going to say next. The Talmud has such a statement, a passage in the Talmud, that a blind person is considered like a dead person. So there were some Hungarian rabbis. See, there's a difference here. How do you deal with Paskin and Shiloh? So the Hungarians have the practice of taking any statement that appears anywhere in the Talmud, whether it's in a halachic concept or in an agadic concept. The Talmud has a statement in the context of an agadic discussion. So they would take that as a serious statement. So they say, since the Talmud says that a blind man is considered like a maze, so to give a person the ability to see is considered pikuach nefesh, even if the cornea is also banor minatar, that would constitute pikuach nefesh. So there was a conference of the Rabbinical Council of America many years ago, and someone made a statement in the name of Rabbi Soloveitchik. At that time, Rabbi Soloveitchik was already out of commission. He was old and too weak to consult. He didn't know what was going on at that time. So someone said in his name that that's what he said, that a blind person is considered like a mace, and a mace is so to give someone the ability to see is pikuach nefesh. So his daughter, in the last years of his life after Mrs. Soloveitchik passed away, so he moved in with his daughter, the Twerskys. So his daughter was very upset why they printed such a thing in the name of her father. So she wrote a humorous news piece, which was circulating in the yeshiva. It was reported in the name of Rabbi Soloveitchik that the Talmud says that Oni Choshev Kemet, a poor person, is considered like dead. And whoever makes less than $50,000 a year is considered an Oni. So he's allowed to take a job to be Mechal Shabbos to make more than $50,000. Because that's considered Pikuach Nefesh. So she thought, she's a learned woman, she's a smart cookie. So she thought that this is in the same context. The Talmud says that the blind person is considered like a mace, like the Oni is considered like a mace. So she thought that just like that was ridiculous. She thought this was equally ridiculous in her father's way of thinking. Many Hungarian rabbanim quote that passage in the Talmud, that a blind person is considered like a mace, and that's considered pikuach nefesh. But her father would never have made such a statement. One has to research it. One might, I'm a layman, I don't know. I would guess that probably a blind person will not live as long as a person who can see. Not only because he lost his eyesight because of a sickness that's going to cause him to die earlier. Let's say he doesn't have a sickness that's going to cause him to die. I would assume blind people, they can get run over by cars. No, they can get hurt. They can fall. They can get in accidents more so than the people who can see. So I would guess probably that blind people don't have the same the same life expectancy as people who they have the ability to see. That's also considered pikuach nefesh. Pikuach nefesh doesn't only mean my life is in danger and you save my life. If there's something that, if I'll extend my life for another week, that's also called pikuach nefesh. You can never tell, it's very iffy. So we should you should look in on the internet to find out what is the life expectancy of blind people as opposed to the life expectancy of people who can't see. If it's better life expectancy for people who can see, forgetting about the sickness, unless the sickness may hasten his death, okay, then for sure. So then for sure be considered a pikuach nefesh situation. The big question is, though, that the vital organs, when you're taking a vital organ from a dead body, it doesn't help. The cornea can be taken from a person who's dead, but the other vital organs really have to be taken from a person who's brain dead. So that's the question: does the halacha recognize brain death? When is a patient really dead? So Moshe Feinstein has an interesting tshuva before brain death, before anyone ever dreamt about brain death. Moshe Feinstein discusses the following shaila. A person is paralyzed on the left side of his body. A religious Jew puts on tefillin on his left arm, and his left arm is paralyzed. Is he in fulfillment of the mitzvah of tefillin if he puts tefillin on a paralyzed arm? So he writes, absolutely yes. How is he so convinced that yes? Because his father had a stroke a half a year before he died. Moshe Feinstein's father was a prominent rabbi, and his father was paralyzed on his left side, and he continued to put on tefillin. Say, no, that's the din, because that's what father did. That's the law. Now, how did his father know? That's the next question. How did his father know? So Moshe Feinstein quotes a Gemara in Bechoris. The Gemara in Bechoris, in the middle of Bechoris, the Gemara talks about Mumin. Kain, who is a Balmum, is not permitted to offer Karbanos in the Beis HaMikdash, and an animal which is a Balmum may not be offered as a sacrifice on the Mizbeach, on the altar in the temple. So the Gemara discusses the Mechusar Aver. If an animal is missing a limb, even by oath, where there's no psula balmon, but mechusar eiver is possible. So mechusar eiver doesn't only mean if it's missing a limb, if there's no longer blood circulation to any given limb, if there's a cessation, if there's a permanent cessation of blood circulation to a limb, that limb is considered dead even though it's still attached to the body. But as long as the blood is still circulating, just that part of the body is paralyzed, that means the nervous system isn't functioning, but the blood is still circulating, so then that organ is considered alive. If there's no longer, if you put a tourniquet and you stop the blood, but you can take off the tourniquet, and the blood will continue to, you just put it temporarily, so they don't say that part of the arm is dead already. But if you put a tourniquet long enough, that even if you take it off, the blood is not going to circulate, that limb is going to die, so then once the blood circulation stopped to the extent that it can no longer be recovered, it can no longer be restored, that limb is considered dead. So Moshe Feinstein derives from that Gemara that the definition of life and death in limbs has to do with blood circulation. Basically, it's Psukim in the Chumash like that. It's interesting that the medical world wasn't aware of blood circulation until the 1600s or the 1700s. The Psukim and the Chumash talk about blood circulation. The Gemara has demon based on blood circulation. It's surprising. How come the world of medicine wasn't aware of what it said in Chumash? The Pasuk says in Chumash, when a person is, if I kill someone, Yechayv Nisa, if I murder someone, I'm Chayv Nisa, unless the person is declared as a Gabra Ktila. If the Halacha sometimes has people who are alive, but we declare that they're not considered alive. But the Chumash uses the expression, Ein Lo Domin. We treat it as if he doesn't have blood circulating in his body, and therefore if you kill him, you're not chayv nisa. Another person whom you might have thought mistakenly is a gabra ktila, is dead, and the pasuk says, no, it's not correct. So it says, domim lo, in Parshas Mishpatim. It says, domim lo. So the Ibn Ezra, the Gaon Vilna, say, what does it mean, domim lo? His blood is circulating. He is alive. The definition of life and death on any given organ, Moshe Feinstein quotes the Gemara in Bechoris, has to do with circulation of blood. If the blood is circulating, the oxygen, then it's going to keep that organ alive, it's going to keep the cells alive. So the blood circulation makes it that organ is alive. And to determine whether a person is alive or dead has to do with the vital organs. He can be missing all of his fingers and all of his toes and his ears and his nose and his eyes, but if the vital organs are still alive, then the person is still alive. But if the blood circulation has stopped in an irreversible fashion from the vital organs, then the patient is considered dead. The Talmud, in the end of Yuma, has a discussion about how do you determine when a person is dead. Let's say, when did the Chevet Kadisha start to do their work? When do they decide that the patient is dead? So, the Gemara, based on the Gemara and the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, if the person stopped breathing, so you wait 15, 20 minutes, and then he's not breathing for 15, 20 minutes, you assume that he is dead. So, the Gemara says this is based on the Pasuk in Parshas Noach, when the Torah describes the Mabul. So the Torah says that all of the living animals died. Kol asher nishmas ruach chayim biyapov meisim. Kol asher becharav meisim. All the living animals, all the living people, all those who were breathing, so they all drowned. So the Gemara says, you see that that's the definition. The Gemara sounds like it says that's the definition of life and death. Nishmas ruach chayim biyapov. If a person is breathing, then if an animal is breathing, then it's alive. If it's not breathing, then it's dead. So the Chasam Sofer has an interesting tshuva that was written to Rav Zvi Hirsch Chayes. It's very interesting. The Chassam Sefer has hundreds of tshuvas. Chassam Sefer lived in the middle of the 1800s. He has hundreds of tshuvas. All the tshuvas start off via so-and-so. He tells you who the tshuva was written to. Like Moshe Feinstein, like most of the Rabban Pin tshuvas, they tell you who the tshuva is written to. There are less than 10, maybe less than 5. I mean, and I think there are less than 5 tshuvas in the Chassam Sefer's volumes of tshuvas where he doesn't have the name of the person. So this is one of the tshuvas where he doesn't have the person's name. Because he writes in the middle of the tshuva, "Are you an apikoros? What's wrong with you? You don't believe in the Torah?" So he didn't put the name of the person. But the person to whom he sent the tshuva was so proud of his correspondence with the Chassam Sefer, so he printed a volume, "My Correspondence with the Chassam Sefer." That was Reb Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, Maritz Chayes. He was the Rav in Zalkava, a village in Galicia. So every paragraph of the Chassam Sefer's tshuva goes paragraph by paragraph in response to every paragraph in the Maritz Chayes' shaila. So you read the shaila. If you don't read the shaila, you don't understand the tshuva of Chassam Sefer. That's very interesting. It's damn interesting. Moshe Feinstein wrote tshuvas, so you don't have to read what the shaila was. He'll explain the shaila and he'll explain all the sources. He goes from the beginning to the end. The Chassam Sefer, a lot of times you don't begin to understand what in the world he's talking about because you don't know what he's responding to. You know, he doesn't give you the story from the beginning to the end. So here also, in this tshuva, all of a sudden, in the middle of a tshuva, he says, and the Rambam writes in the Mora Nevuchim, whoever quotes a Mora Nevuchim in the middle of a tshuva, because Reb Tzvi Hirsch Chayes quoted the Mora Nevuchim. So he's responding, yeah, the Rambam writes in the Mora Nevuchim. Every paragraph in the Chassam Sefer's tshuva is in response to every paragraph in the Maritz Chayes' shaila that he said. So the Maritz Chayes wrote like this: the countries in Europe at that time in the 1800s, middle 1800s, passed the law. Some countries still have the law. I think Switzerland still has the law that you're not allowed to bury a dead body until 72 hours have passed since the death certificate was signed. Because every so often they make a mistake and the doctor's right that the fellow is dead and is really not dead. You know, when you go to the A&P, so when you check out, at the checkout counter, so they sell these funny newspapers, National Enquirer. So they always have funny news. So they have every 5 years they have a piece that someone, they were having a funeral service in a church, and the pastor was delivering a eulogy, and the guy gets up and he says, "What do you mean? What's going on here? I'm alive. What are they delivering a eulogy?" So that's what happened in the 1800s. And they were afraid that the doctors were determining that people were dead, they were really alive. So they made a law that you're not allowed to bury anybody until 72 hours go by since he was declared as dead, then you'll know he's really dead. So this is against our law. I think they still have it in Switzerland, if I'm not mistaken. So the Jews are dying in Switzerland, so they take them out of the country and they bury them. They try to bury them on the same day. So the shaila was then, in the 1800s, should the Orthodox Jews go along with the Dina de Malchusa or not? So Tzvi Hirsch Chayes sent a letter. He was an Orthodox rabbi, but he had modern Balabatim. And he sent a letter to the Chassam Sefer, and maybe we should go along with the Dina de Malchusa, because the Talmud tells stories like that. The Talmud tells a story that someone came to the cemetery to visit the grave of a dear one of his, and he hears knocking on the door. One of the dead people, there was a mausoleum, and one of the dead people crawled out of his grave and knocked on the door, let me out of here. They locked me in here. I'm still alive. So the Talmud relates such a story in Maseches Smochas. Such a story is there. And there's such a Mishnah in the end of Maseches Nido that after a person dies, he still has the tumah like a zab until the body starts to decay because maybe he's still alive. Not only does he have the tumah like a mace, he has the tumah like a living person who's alive. Azab. So the Mishnayos say apparently sometimes the doctors make a mistake. And the rabbis were concerned about such a possibility. So that's what Reb Tzvi Hirsch Chayes says. Maybe we should go along with what the doctor said. Maybe we're not so convinced that just because the tradition is if he stops breathing for 15, 20 minutes and we assume he's dead, maybe we should reconsider that. And then the Maritz Chayes quotes a passage from the Rambam in the Mora Nevuchim. The Rambam quotes from Galen. Galen was a Greek doctor, I think. Every so often it quotes from Galen's writing, that they have recorded in medical history that a patient stopped breathing for 3 days, and after 3 days he came to, and he revived. So you see that it's possible for a person not only to stop breathing for 20 minutes, he can stop breathing for 3 days and then come back to life. It depends what the body is warm or the body is cold. If the body is warm, it means that that he's still alive. The body starts to get cold, so you see that he's dead. So this is what the Maritz Chais asked the Hasan Sefer. That the Rambam writes in the Mor Nevuchim that just because a patient is not breathing, it doesn't necessarily mean that he's dead. But they have recorded in the medical history that a person wasn't breathing for 3 days and then he came to afterwards. So the Hasan Sefer responds back. He says, that story in the Talmud about the guy who came to the cemetery and he hears someone knocking on the door, get me out of here, they locked me in. That'll happen once in 500 years. That's not called the suffix, Sakonis Nefesh. Something is going to happen once in 10,000 cases. That's not, if it's 1 out of 100, 1 out of 500, okay, 1 out of a million, that's ridiculous. That's so far-fetched, that's not called the suffix, Sakonis Nefesh. And then he says, you're right, that inability to breathe is not the definition of death. It's not when the rabbis comment on the pasuk in Parshas Noach, Kolosh and Nishmas Ruach Chaim B'Yapov, that the people who were, the animals and the people who were breathing, all died, and the description of life is breathing, and implying that the description of death is when you're not breathing. He says, I think you're right. That's not the definition of life and death. That's a similar dover. The definition of life and death is something else. He doesn't discuss what. He says, usually if the person is not breathing for 20 minutes, we assume that he's dead. He says, when Moshe Rabbeinu was given the mitzvah to bury the people in the same day that they died, the Rebbe Shlomo must have told them, how do you determine whether the person is dead? So we follow the Rube, that if the body, the person is not moving, is not breathing for 20 minutes, and the body is not warm anymore, so we assume the patient is dead. True, it may happen once out of 100,000 that the patient is still alive. We don't have to be concerned about that. You don't postpone the kvura for 3 days. You don't postpone the kvura even for 1 day in violation of the mitzvah and the Torah because of such a far-fetched possibility that the person is still alive. So that's the famous tshuva of the Chasam Sofer where he says that breathing is only a similar dover. When the person is not breathing, that's not the definition of death. That's what some of the doctors say today, some of the rabbis, some of the doctors say, if this stem of the brain is dead, so the stem of the brain controls the breathing, then since the patient doesn't have the ability to breathe on his own, even though you put him on a respirator, so the respirator is helping him breathe, but since he doesn't have independent breathing, so he's considered dead. So the Chasam Sofer, I think, would not agree with that. That's not the definition of life and death. But Moshe Feinstein quoted from the Psukim and from the Gemara that the definition of life and death is blood circulation. So if the patient is on a respirator, and the respirator sends the blood with the oxygen to all the organs of the body, so that's considered alive, that's not considered dead. The breathing is a similar davar, that he probably is dead already, probably the blood stopped circulating, but if I know the blood is circulating, it's on a respirator, the blood is circulating, it just doesn't have independent breathing, so the pashta says that that's not considered, it's not considered dead. But Moshe Feinstein says, if he says, a person whose left arm is paralyzed can still fulfill the mitzvah of tefillin on the left arm, the arm is alive. If the left arm would be gangrenous, there's no blood circulating, then the arm is dead. Even though the arm is still attached to the body, but it's dead. No, a dead arm. You're not yet to the mitzvah of tefillin on the dead arm. But kozman, the blood is still circulating, then we assume that the patient is still alive. So really this position is not, the overwhelming majority of the Rabbanim all over the world have not accepted brain death. It's not really a medical shaila. It's a philosophical or a religious shaila. The doctors can't determine what's life and death. The doctors can describe what the situation is. Then they have to ask philosophers or they have to ask theologians whether the patient is alive or dead. So they give us a description of the situation. The person doesn't have the ability to breathe on his own, but he's on a respirator. And the respirator is sending the blood all over the body, so the blood is circulating oxygen, and the oxygen is still keeping the organs alive. The organs are not dead. The organs are not decaying yet. So that's a question of, that's not a medical question. The doctors can only give you a description of the situation. This halachic question, is he alive or dead? The simple reading of the sources in the Talmud seem to indicate that the person is still alive. They once told Rabbi Soloveitchik, when he was already very old and sick, they told him that a certain prominent rabbi gave a lecture, he visited out of town, he was giving a lecture on brain death. And he was very upset about that. So he said, how can people take a stand on this issue? He said he thinks even if the Vilna Gaon would be alive today, there are not sufficient sources in the Talmud to determine whether we hold from brain death or not. How can you take a stand on this? So the question is, when the blood is still circulating to all the vital organs, and all the vital organs are still alive, then we would assume the patient is still alive. How many vital organs have to die? The blood stops circulating to one vital. Sometimes you have a person, his kidneys are dead. You don't need both kidneys to live, but you need one kidney in order to live. One kidney is a vital organ. So how many vital organs do you need to die that the patient should be considered dead? First of all, how many vital organs are there? That's question number one. How many vital organs are there? So in the Mishnayos, they only talk about three vital organs. They speak about the heart, the brain, and the liver. These are the only three. The heart, the brain, and the liver. So that's the question. Is that to be taken literally? That's the halacha only recognizes three vital organs, and we ignore all the others? Or do we say no? Lab dafke these three. The Rambam only quotes these three. The Mishnahs only have these three. So that's question number one. The Chasam Sofer raises this question in his tshuva. Does the halacha, do we have a halacha Moshe? We seem to have a tradition for the days of Moshe Rabbeinu that we only consider these three. Or we say no. You have to ask the doctors which are the vital organs that are necessary. Once you establish how many vital organs you're dealing with, either three or however many there are, then the question is how many of the vital organs have to be dead? Dead means that there's no blood circulating in an irreversible fashion. How many vital organs have to be dead that you should consider the patient as being dead? So if you would have asked me, I would have said one vital organ is gone. So he's not alive anymore. In order to be alive, you need all the vital organs. So I can visualize one taking the position that if a person's kidneys are both gone, if both kidneys are no longer functioning, there's no blood circulating to the kidney, I could visualize that one would say the person is dead. So another rabbi says to me, what do you mean? It can be dancing at a wedding. Not exactly dancing at a wedding. He can attend the wedding. He can have a person, sometimes you have an old grandfather, great grandfather attends the wedding, both of his kidneys are gone and he's going to die within a couple of days. So I said, I can visualize that Allah will declare that such a person is dead. The kidney is a vital organ. It has no kidneys are functioning. I can visualize that person is dead. I can understand the physician. You say, you need all the vital organs should be dead. In order to declare the whole organism is dead, you need all the vital organs are dead. I can understand the physician. You can say, the rove, ubikukula, the majority. You have to make up your mind how many vital organs are there. Only three. Only the three that the Mishnayos and the Rambam talk about. Or we recognize whatever medicine says is a vital organ. We'll add on more than three. I can visualize that we should go basar ripes. I can see all these possibilities. But to declare that there's a difference between the stem of the brain and the other vital organs, we have no source in the Talmud for this. If you want to give a halachic definition of life and death, you have to use concepts that the rabbis in the Talmud were familiar with. The concept of vital organs they were familiar with. The concept of blood circulation they were familiar with. And this is relevant in halacha. Take for example, if one causes bleeding on Shabbos, that constitutes a malacha. So which is the malacha? Why are you not permitted to squeeze out blood? So Tosfos says, this is based on a passage in the Talmud Yerushalmi, that this is a violation of Netilas Neshama. Why is it Netilas Neshama? So Tosfos quotes the pasuk in the Chumash, Ki Hadam Hu HaNefesh, because the blood circulation keeps people alive. So if you squeeze out a little blood, even though the whole organism is alive, the Tosfos uses an expression that appears in the Talmud, Malikot Lekula, Malikot Lepalga. It doesn't make a difference whether you kill the whole organism or you kill part of the organism. So this is to develop the definition of halachic definition of life and death. You can't give fancy medical terms. You have to use concepts that the rabbis in the Talmud were familiar with. You have to, vital organs have to play a role. That's what Moshe Feinstein writes in one of his tshuvas. He said that someone said, if the person can't breathe through his nose, then he's considered dead. So Moshe Feinstein says, what, the nose is one of the vital organs? Something new? A person can live without a nose. That's not the definition of the definition of life and death has something to do with vital organs. So that's the question. How many vital organs are there? Does the halacha only count on three, or do we consider whatever the doctors say? They're all vital organs. And then once you determine that, which is up in the air, then you have to determine how many of the vital organs have to be dead. One, all, or rove of the vital organs. So that's why the overwhelming majority of the rabbanim in the world have not accepted brain death. We would assume that a brain-dead patient is is a Safik Chai Safik Meis. I would assume it's a Safik Chai Safik Meis. I would assume he's a Trefa. There's a concept of a Gosek. Let's say a person is going to die at the age of 120. Let's make believe. And he's 119 and 353 days, and he has another couple of hours to go, then he's going to drop dead. Let's make believe. So the person is going to die. That's a gosis. And if one hastens the death of a gosis, the Mishnah says, chai misa. A gosis is kechai. But if one kills a trefa means a person has tissue damage, which is going to cause him to die within 12 months. Here, this sub is going to die within hours. But he's a gosis. So a gosis is kechai, goma. If a person is a trefa, he has tissue damage, which is going to cause him to die within 12 months. So then we say one who kills a trefa is not chayiv nisa. So the pashtus is over here, a brain dead patient would probably be considered a trefa. So what's taked it in? You're not permitted to kill a trefa, but if one does murder a trefa, you're not chayiv nisa. So are you allowed to kill a trefa to save the life of a sholem? Am I allowed to kill this trefa in order to take his organ, in order to save someone else's life? The other person will live on a significant, reasonable life now. So that was a big dispute in the 1700s. So the Shai Berlin thought that that's permissible. He said, killing a trefa, you're not chai misa. So it makes sense to him. He thought that you're permitted to kill a trefa to save the life of a sholem. And the Nadi Yehuda's opinion was accepted that it's not allowed. That even though one kills a trefa, it's not chai misa, But he thought that still it's an Isirit Sicha, so you're not permitted to kill a trefa, even to save the life of the shaman. So the way it's usually assumed, the brain dead patient is still alive. And the most you can say about him, a Safik Chai, Safik Meis, the most you can say is that he's a trefa, but we don't allow killing a trefa in order to save the life of a shaman. So that's why most of the organ transplants that they do from dead bodies, that they're taking a vital organ to save someone else's life, it only works when the patient is still alive, when the donor, in quotation marks, he didn't donate anything, when the donor is still alive, it's a euphemism, we call him the donor, when the donor is still alive, he's just brain dead. So the Rabbanim are not prepared to assume that that's permissible. We usually assume that that's not allowed. The halacha says that the death penalty is only given to one who murders a Jew. One who murders a non-Jew is not guilty, is not chayiv misa, but it's still prohibited. So that's the question. Would you permit killing a trefa to save a sholem? One who kills a trefa is not chayiv misa. So one who kills a nochri is not chayiv misa. If one would be make of that to kill a trefa to save a sholem would be allowed, so then one could visualize such a position that the killer not. But we don't accept that either. We don't allow killing a trefa to save a shalom. So that's why it's usually assumed that it doesn't make a difference.
What happens if a baby who's born anencephalic, no brain, where they don't live more than 2 or 3 days? Is it allowed to use him as a donor when he's still alive?
The Talmud speaks about a nafel. A nafel means a baby that was born prematurely, and the vital organs weren't sufficiently developed, like over here. So a nafel is considered like in limbo. You're not permitted to kill him, but he's not a chai, he's not a mace. So we wouldn't permit killing such a nafel in order to save the life of a person who is healthy. All nephilim, they're not chai, but they're not mace at the same time. So we wouldn't permit. We would consider that ritzicha. We wouldn't allow it.
I was a resident when that happened in Brooklyn. It was going to be the first transplant in the world.
So did they consult Rabbanim at that time?
The pediatricians were not allowed to remove the heart and the baby died.
And then it was useless? Then it wasn't useful, yeah. If the physician is not permitted, if we should assume that the physician is in violation of Ritzicha to kill the brain dead patient by taking out his organs, so he violated Ritzicha when he did that, is there anything wrong with the patient receiving this organ? So Rabbi Tendler built up a whole argument which has merit, that one is not permitted to save his life at the expense of someone else's life. There seem to be sources in the Gemara that might indicate that, but that's not the generally accepted view. Most of the Rabbanim will say that you're not permitted to kill the patient, but once the doctors are going to kill the patient anyway, now the whole list of people who are interested in using his heart or his organs or whatever, so you can put your list, you can put your name on the list as a recipient if they're anyway going to kill him. There was merit to Rabbi Tendler's argument that there are sources that seem to indicate like that, that if that is an act of murder, so you're not allowed to save your life at the other fellow's expense. But the bottom line, we don't pass like that. It's assumed that it is permissible.
From a public policy, it's challenging to sell the property that we take that we don't give. How does that factor in?
Many argue the point that if it'll become public knowledge that Orthodox Jews don't permit donating organs, so then the world will not give us organs. When we'll be dying, the world won't give us organs. Look, we're not allowed to permit ritzicha in order to save people's lives. If they won't give us organs, they won't give us organs. What can we do? If you're not allowed to, you're not allowed to.
Assuming that the blind person is dead, can you take an order from him?
Assuming that?
Blind person's dead, can you take an order?
I mean, if you consider a blind person is dead, no. You get the death penalty if you kill a blind person. For sure you get the death penalty. That for sure you're not allowed to kill.
The Chinese recently have been shown to be executing prisoners and then using the organs for transplant.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, would they be acceptable?
Strictly speaking, they're acceptable. Look, to save someone's life, you can do it. Even if they're doing something wrong by killing their prisoners, but still, once you have an organ. The question is, maybe as a matter of public policy, maybe we shouldn't support their atrocities. The world has to decide whether yes or no. Yeah.
I just had a couple of questions. The first one about transplantation. So when a donor is kept alive, in order to provide the organs for transplant. So if there were no artificial measures, in other words, not only for the breathing, but also for the circulation, which is what we consider as the life itself, halakhically. So if left to the natural occurrence, that patient would have no circulation as well, but what we do is artificially augment the circulation until the time of the donor process. So how does that play in for the whole? In other words, really, he wouldn't be alive. He wouldn't have circulation, but you're
keeping
him on
massive
doses of artificial. Right. So.
So the question is, are you permitted to artificially extend
well,
his life?
Is that person really considered alive? Because
bottom line is still alive, and many people alive today, if they would have lived 100 years ago, they would have not been alive. But lemaisa in our generation, they are still alive.
That makes no difference. The fact that they're artificially.
Right. The only question is it permissible to extend a person's life artificially in order to harvest organs? So Moshe Feinstein writes about that. So he says it is not. People make a mistake. They think that the Jewish position always is you always extend life under all circumstances. He says this is not correct. Someone sent such a question to the Stipler. So he also wrote, as children, it was ingrained within us that you always extend Jewish life, you always extend life whenever possible. And then we grew a little old and we studied Gemara, we studied Shulchan Aruch. You see that it's not so. Sometimes it's not a mitzvah to extend life. Sometimes it's even a mitzvah indirectly to hasten the death of a person if he's suffering. So Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he says if the patient is suffering in pain and you're going to extend his life in order to harvest organs, so he said that's an aveira to extend his life, even not to harvest organs. Let's say the person has an attitude, the ultra-Orthodox religious person thinks that you always have to extend life. So he leaves instructions, you should always extend my life even if I'm absolutely suffering. So Moshe Feinstein says you're not allowed to listen to those instructions. You have to let him die. Extending his life is an aveira of chovel b'haveiro. If you cause a person to be in pain for longer than normally he would have already died. It would have expired. And we're extending his life and he's suffering longer. So that's an aveira to extend his life. Surprising tshuva. That's what he says. You're not allowed to artificially extend a person's life if it's just going to cause them more suffering.
So, also, I had a question about the example that Salvita gave with the crime and the cholera epidemic. So I wanted to know, halakhically, if there's a difference between, in the instance of the cholera epidemic, so you have a situation of one person or multiple people have an opportunity to save multiple lives versus being able to save one life. Does that make any difference? If halakhically, in other words, putting yourself at risk to save possibly multiple lives or only possibly saving one life. Does the possibility of saving multiple lives
I don't think so. I think he followed that opinion that one is obligated to put his, an individual person obligated to put his life in danger, even to save the life of one person, not only many people. It does play a role in Shulchan Aruch to save the life of Klal Yisrael, not a minion of 10 people, not 100 people. If you're going to save the life of Klal Yisrael, if you have such a far-fetched situation, so Esther was permitted to violate Gilui Arayis and to go into Achashverosh in order to save Klal Yisrael. Because the majority of the Jews in her Jerusalem Jews at that time, their lives were in danger. So that was a special Esther. But just to save the life of many people is the same as saving the life of one person. Yes, Rabbi.
You're allowed to be more powerful when a person should die. You're running to the door, and that would be one consideration. And what feelers do we make if a person is deathly ill? The doctors say, you know, he's bad situation. Are we mispallowed to him when we say she had a rapport shalema if the rain is already in very bad shape? First thing is, can we mispallowed to him?
The Ran in Adarim has that comment that sometimes it's a mitzvah to pray that a person should die. The person is suffering so much, it's a rachmana, so we should pray that he should die. They have in the Tshuvas of Rav Chaim Falaji, the later Poskim quote this halacha l'maisa, there was a husband who felt that his wife was suffering, and he wanted out of rachmana, he wanted to pray that his wife should die. Rav Chaim Falaji told him, that's not nice. The husband should pray that his wife should die. The people would think that they didn't get along. He said, ask other people to pray that she should die. You shouldn't be the one to pray. Okay. I remember many years ago, the first time I visited Eretz Yisrael, so we spent a bit of time in Bnei Brak in the Panevish Yeshiva at that time. So there was the yeshiva after Mincha was saying to Tehillim, there was someone who was seriously sick with cancer, and the doctors thought that the case was hopeless. So everybody was saying Tehillim, and the Mashgiach refused to say Tehillim. Rav Chatzka Levenstein. He says, how are you allowed to say Tehillim? You're not allowed to ask God for a miracle. They said, B'derech HaTeva, the man is going to die. He said, he's not going to say Tehillim. So Shmuel Razovsky was standing next to him, and he told him, no, he has the same, they said, he has the same degree of cancer that the other fellow had, and the other fellow pulled through. So there is hope, B'derech HaTeva, it is possible. He says, okay, then he's going to say Tehillim. But he says, to be mispowel for a person, that the doctors think that B'derech HaTeva, it's impossible that he should get cured. You're not permitted to ask God for a prayer. The Gemara says, the Mishnah says, if a woman is pregnant and she already has 10 girls, she wants a boy, she has 10 boys, she wants a girl, but she's already pregnant. So the Mishnah says, she's not allowed to pray that it should be a boy, it should be a girl. Either it's a boy or a girl. It's too late to pray now. Pray before you become pregnant. You're not allowed to ask God to do a miracle, to change the baby from one to the other. You're not permitted to be mispallel for a chayla that the doctors have given up hope b'derech hateva. That's not permissible. Sometimes you don't know whether b'derech hateva it's possible that he should survive or not. So we have to pray to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He should have rachmanis on the patient. Rachmanis sometimes means God should take his life, have rachmanis. Sometimes rachmanis means to extend his life that he should be healthy. But to ask God, please give a refuah shleima for so-and-so. Sometimes you're asking for a miracle. The nusach of the tefillah should be, have rachmanis and so-and-so. You know what rachmanis is. God knows what the rachmanis is.
Is the obligation of care for a treifa any different? Or is it based upon suffering?
One is obligated to care for a treifa the same as anybody else. Yeah. But you have to keep in mind, if the person is suffering, so it's really up to the patient. It's an iffy situation. How serious is the pain, and how much does the person want to live? So, whenever it's clear cut, then we don't consult the patient. Take for example, the Magen Avraham in his commentary on Hilchos Shabbos quotes a tshuva from the Radvaz that goes as follows: a young person, 20 years old, has gangrene in his leg. and the doctors say, we want to cut off the leg and give you a plastic leg, a wooden leg, whatever, and you live another 100 years to be able to function normally. We've done the surgery, we've done this many times over, and then no sakonis involved. Everything's going to be okay. And the 20-year-old patient says, I'd rather die than live another 100 years with a wooden leg. So the Magen Avraham Kosher Radar, that's utterly ridiculous, and you're not allowed to listen to the patient, and you do the surgery against his wishes. In America, I understand, it's not permissible. You're not allowed to do any surgery without the consent of the patient. But if the Israeli government will be run by the Degel HaTorah, or the Aguda, or the Mizrahi, whatever, so I guess they'll follow the Magen Avraham. So it says, in such a situation, you do the surgery against the wishes of the patient. The patient has no right to choose such an utterly ridiculous choice. So Moshe Feinstein writes in the other direction. Let's say the patient is suffering something terrible, and there's no chance that he's going to recover anyway. And he, out of his religious conviction, says, I want you to extend my life under all circumstances, even though I'm going to be in excruciating pain. Extend my life. So Moshe Feinstein says, you're not allowed to listen to the patient. That's an avera to extend his life, because he's causing him more suffering. Like this, he would have died today. Like this, he suffers for another 2 months pain. So he says, the patient has no right to choose such an utterly ridiculous choice. But let's say it's iffy. A situation, he is in pain, and he's losing his hair, whatever, but he's going to live a little longer, and he'll see the grandchildren, whatever, so some people would say yes, some people would say no. See, even though 95% or 99% of the people would say, let me die in peace already, but 1% of the people would say not so. If you would take a poll of 1,000 people, the 999 would say, let me die in peace, and one Meshuggah says, I want to live on, so then you say, Batla Daita, then you say, he has no right to choose such an unreasonable choice. But if there's a significant minority of people who would choose this option, then it's up to the patient to decide. We said before that sometimes the patient determines whether you're doing him a favor or not. Are you doing me a favor by extending my life or not? So sometimes it's up to the patient to make that decision.
Would it be permissible for a terminal patient to undergo a procedure that has a very low likelihood of success if it's an experimental and investigational procedure that may help other people further on? But in other words, the possibility of success of extending that terminal patient's life is rather minimal, but has the possibility of extending medical science to the point where they can perform procedures in the future that may be helpful for individuals in that circumstance.
I don't know about that. I think we assume the patient could put his life into danger. He may risk losing the 2 or 3 months that he has to go for the chance of living longer. Let's say they'll do a procedure to him. Like this, they think he's going to live 3 months, and if they'll do the procedure, they think he stands a chance of living 10 months. But Ben Kolako, he's not going to live more than 12 months. They don't think he stands a chance. So then Rav Moshe Feinstein says he's not permitted to vomit, he's not permitted to make that choice. It's only if it's Chayi Olam versus Chayi Shah. Chayi Olam doesn't mean he's going to live forever. Nobody lives forever. He says Chayi Olam is going to live more than 12 months. Chayi Shah means he doesn't have 12 months to go. So if there's a chance, if there's even a slim chance that the procedure may extend my life, that I'll live more than 12 months, so then I'm permitted to make that choice. But if it's so far-fetched, it's really unreasonable, then I don't think the patient would be allowed to make that decision, even if he's going to help for the future, to save other people's lives. He's not allowed to give up his life to save other people's lives.
So the cutoff is basically a 12-month extension of life?
Right, that's what's assumed, right? If that's slightly reasonable, but if it's utterly unreasonable, totally unreasonable, then even that would not be allowed.
Just for clarification, so if the opinion that Rav Soloveitchik gave that we are obligated actually to put our life at risk for others if we're in the medical profession, is that what the majority of opinion is now, that as a physician you're obligated to put yourself in danger? And then secondly, does it matter at all if the people that you're treating are Jewish or
non-Jewish? I don't think that's the majority opinion. Rabbi Soloveitchik's grandfather had a lot of original opinions. This was his opinion, that one is obligated. I think most assume that it's not obligatory. The first Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Baal HaTanya, rightly thinks it's forbidden in his Shulchan Aruch. And the Lubavitcher always follow his position, the position of the first Rebbe. And those who disagree would probably not say that you're obligated to. They would probably say it's permissible to volunteer. But to say you're obligated, probably not. You should ask his local Orthodox rabbi. The same rabbi that he asks his kashrus shilas and his shabbos shilas, so he should ask his shilas.
I mean, I'm saying it's not the same thing as a patient who's choosing between, like, they have the choice to choose between having a procedure that could possibly extend their life versus possibly shortening it. It seems like it's a similar kind of...
No, that halacha says that's up to the patient to determine, are we doing him a favor or not? Over here it's a question on halacha for the doctor. Is the doctor permitted or obligated or prohibited from dealing with this patient?
And whether you're treating Jews or non-Jews? So.
There is a difference. The mitzvah to treat the patient to heal them only applies to Jewish patients. To treat a non-Jew is, we're not allowed to violate Isurim in order to treat a non-Jew. We're not allowed to be Mechal Shabbos and so on. Under the circumstances, it says in the Shulchan Aruch, we have no choice, we have to be Mechal Shabbos to save the non-Jews also, otherwise they'll make a pogrom. So we're not really being Mechal Shabbos to save the lives of the non-Jews. We're being Mechal Shabbos. You can't run a hospital that's only for Jews. Shari Tzedek Hospital and all the hospitals in Eretz Yisrael, they treat the Arabs the exact same way they treat the Jews on Shabbos, because it just doesn't function otherwise. It's a pikuach nefesh for the Jews. But strictly speaking, theoretically, it never comes up in Maaseh. Theoretically, if you're just dealing with the life of a non-Jew, one is not permitted to do Isurim to save their lives. Let's say someone, there's a non-Jew who is dying and they want people to donate blood. So the Pashto says that donating blood is a prohibition. That it's chavola, you're mutilating your body. It's only permissible to donate blood if the blood may save the life of another Jewish person. So let's say in New York City, so the more blood there is in the blood bank, so the more, even if my pint of blood for sure is going to go to a non-Jew, but the more blood there is in the blood bank, so the more Jewish lives will be saved. So even if my pint of blood is going to go to a non-Jew, that's called the Sofik Bikloch Nefesh. At the end of the day, you're going to save the life of another Jew.
So doesn't that, Dr. Rodwell asked about donating a Jewish organs to non-Jews in order that Jews who need organs can get from non-Jews, otherwise there will be a pogrom and Orthodox Jews won't be able to get organs and they'll be dying for no reason. Isn't that the same thing?
It's a possibility that it may happen, but we haven't heard that it happened yet.
What about the case where you are like extending someone's life artificially with vasopressors and keeping their blood circulating and they're on a ventilator and can you do that for a non-Jew?
Are you permitted to? Why not?
Keep their body alive in order to harvest the organs.
Ah, I mean, and they're going to be in pain.
No, I don't think they're in pain.
They're very comatose. They're not feeling anything.
Yeah.
They're on.
You mean to harvest the organs is we assume is a form of ritzicha. They're not permitted to kill non-Jews.
Okay, so for all that, it doesn't make a difference whether you're Jewish or not.
I don't think so. That doesn't make a difference.
Another, I guess, sort of similarly related question that I have philosophically in the people category. The situation arises often when you're treating patients in critical situations where you have a patient who doesn't accept any blood products, like a Jehovah's Witness patient, and they, you know, refuse any human blood products at all, and they're bleeding to death, and you're standing there, and you could save their life by giving them blood products, but they don't let you, and so you could just watch them die because you're not allowed to give them any blood products, and the risk of
giving the blood products to you
would be a
trip
to jail, I guess.
I
don't know. I'm considered a
assault.
So I'm just wondering what would be the
can't do anything about it. You let them die in peace? What can you do? They don't let you give them blood, so you know?
They're not conscious, so you can do whatever you want, and maybe you cannot tell them about it. I don't know.
No. If they don't want, they don't want.
You're allowed to let them make that choice.
We should try to convince them that they're making a mistake, that this part of their religion is certainly incorrect. If that's what they say, so goodbye. I'm not obligated to risk my medical practice because this person's religion.
So you're under no obligation halakhically to save their lives if they don't want it to be saved.
I don't think so.
I thought you already said that if they don't have the clock, then they have the brace, that
say that they don't need that, and you can get like a Jehovah's Witness.
They have no right to. Halachically, they have no right to make such a decision. But that's a decision that they made. So I should try to convince them that they're making a mistake. That they, even whatever religion they belong to, this is certainly a mitzvah that you should take blood. But if they don't want it, I'm not going to risk losing my... Pardon me?
It should be up for the doctor.
No, but the patient said in advance he doesn't want any blood transfusions. So nisht is nisht. Goodbye.
Would the fact that some people have rarely overcome a certain disease change whether you can take it home from somebody? Like, if it rarely does happen that this specific disease is naturally overcome, would you be allowed to take it home based on the rare and natural chance?
I mean, sometimes there is a chance, but there are hateva that the yeah. So you're not really asking for a miracle? You're asking that this time the patient should survive. Yeah, that's okay.
Maybe I'm just misunderstanding. If you're donating an organ, but not to a specific person, because kidney donation chain thing that's going on now, where you need your wife needs a kidney, and you've got two healthy kidneys, and she can only get one from the group. There's not a specific donor yet, but if she gets, she wants to go through, you have to be willing to have yourself or someone else donate a kidney. Is that permissible?
Okay. Okay. Because of my donating a kidney to whomever, I stand a better chance of having a Jewish person's life saved. Okay? So that I wasn't. That's okay. That's like donating blood.
I thought that halakhic organ donor business. I've seen the card. It's there in the second year.
Their organization has two different cards. One card says that you should only take my limbs after I'm actually dead and the blood stops circulating, so it's not going to help too much. And then the other card says for those minority of rabbis who do recognize brain death, so the other card says even when I'm brain dead you should take my organs. So this is the big dispute.
I've understood that you can only donate an organ if the patient is, quote, in front of you. And I don't know if that case that she just described is the patient being in front of me.
The idea of the patient in front of you, that's an expression that comes from the Nadi Behuda. The Nadi Behuda lived in the 1700s when they were first developing medicine. They were discovering a lot of things about medicine based on autopsies. So he thinks that it's not permissible to perform an autopsy. It's nivul hames, not allowed to perform an autopsy on a Jewish body. Nivul hames and the bitlav and the mitzvah kfurin. It's an isuri hanoah. You're learning about the medicine. But he says if there's a chayla lefaneinu, if there's a sick person in front of us sick with the same disease, we think that maybe there's a chance that by performing an autopsy on this person who died, we may learn something about the sickness that can save the other one's life. So he says, then you're allowed to perform the autopsy. So this is really a difficult idea that he says, what kind of chayla lefaneinu? Since when do you have to have the chayla lefaneinu? If you think that you'll save someone's life in the future, it should also be mutter to do an autopsy. So the Chazon Ish discusses this difficult line in Rabbi Yehuda. Why did he limit the heter pikuach nefesh only to the situation of chayla lefaneinu? So the Chazon Ish thinks that what the Nadi Behuda meant to say was the following. It's unclear. So he thinks what he meant to say was the following. If you'll permit autopsies, even if there's no chayla lefaneinu, then every single person who will die will insist on doing an autopsy. Because you can always learn, there's a good chance you'll always learn something new about medicine that you never learned. Healthy people, every single person who dies, do an autopsy to discover some new additional information that'll be relevant for the world of medicine. That'll turn out, that will just undo the whole mitzvah, the whole prohibition of autopsies. So the Nadi Behuda felt he has to restrict it somehow. You have to make some arbitrary limit in the situation. So he drew the line, he says, you need a chayla lefaneinu. But over here, we have a situation. There's a person who needs a kidney. And they're not going to give a kidney unless one of the members of the family donates a kidney to the kidney bank, and then then you stand a better chance. So that is like a chayla lefaneinu. That would be okay. Okay. I thank you very much. I had a good time the whole weekend. I thank the whole community of Atlanta. continue to have atzlocha, have nachas from all of your talmidim, from all of your children.
Amen.
Okay, you gotta go.